So this morning we start in Colossians chapter 1, and I remember a story Robin told me about a little girl. I think she was in kindergarten or first grade, and the teacher had assigned the kids to draw a picture of someone or something they really loved. So kids are drawing their pets or their parents or their sister or their favorite toy, and one little girl's as busy going to town on her paper, and the teacher asked her, "Now, what are you drawing?" She says, "I'm drawing God." And the teacher says, "Well, honey, no one knows what God looks like." She said, "They will in a minute." You know, we all want to see God, and I call this chapter, "What Does God Look Like?" And it's been a profound study for me, and I hope it's a blessing to you as it has been to me. And instead of starting with the greeting and the salutations at the very beginning, let's just jump right into the meat and potatoes of the chapter. He talks about the gospel, and then verse 5, because of the hope laid up for you in the heavens, plural, of which you previously heard, and the word of truth of the gospel, which has come to you. Just as in the world also it is constantly bearing fruit and increasing, even as it has been doing in you also since the day you heard of it and come to know the grace of God in truth. Just as you learned it from Epaphras, our beloved fellow bondservant, who is a faithful servant of Messiah on our behalf, and he also informed us of your love in the Spirit. For this reason, verse 9, for this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding. I want to stop there. So, Paul is writing to believers who became believers under the sharing of the gospel by someone named Epaphras. And when Paul heard of their response to the gospel, he says, we just pray constantly that, what does he say? That you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding. And then he goes on. You know, believing is not enough if you want to grow. Believing is the starting point. And he says that he prays that they would be filled with the knowledge of God's will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding. Now, these three terms, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, are terms that are found in this triplet, in this group of three, many times in the Scriptures. Many times. The first time it's found is in Exodus 31:3, where God, through Moses, has given instructions for the building of the tabernacle. And God has set aside Bezalel and Aholiab and their group to do the building. And in 31:3, it says, "And I have filled Bezalel with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding and in knowledge and in all kinds of craftsmanship, all kinds of malacha, all kinds of work." So these three, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, are found a number of times in the Scriptures. Now, what I'm going to do, as we go through, I'm going to give you 10, I don't call them attributes of God, but I maybe would call them the measurements of a king. You know, if you want to know the attributes of God's goodness and glory, you go back to Exodus 34. That's where Moses asked God, "Show me your glory." And God said, "Well, I'll make all my goodness pass before you." And he, you know, he puts him in the cleft, covers him with his hand. God walks by and says, "You can't see my face, but you can look at my back." And he takes his hand away. And then God proclaims his 13 attributes of mercy. These are the 13 things which are the glory of God's goodness itself. But here, we have a list of 10 things. 10 things which are often called midot, which means something that's measured out. Things that are given so they make balance with each other. Things that cannot be done in an extreme way, or things go out of balance. Things that by themselves can be destructive, and only when they have their balancing things can they truly be beneficial and helpful. So these 10 things are very unique. They're very special. And these words that I'll be sharing are found many times in the Hebrew Scriptures. As we were praying this morning, I was following in the Hebrew, and you know, all of these 10 things were mentioned numerous times in the Hebrew prayers this morning. And but as the sages and the rabbis have contemplated these, meditated on these, taught these, memorized these, analyzed them, and applied them to their own lives, they have written book after book after book, and there you could have rooms of books written in Judaism on these 10 things. Unfortunately, in Christianity, we don't hear them at all. So I'm going to introduce you to something that's extremely familiar in the Jewish world and the world of Judaism, something that's very familiar with students of the Hebrew Scriptures, and something that Paul is proclaiming right here in Colossians. And as we look at these things, these midot, these things, these measured out, balanced qualities, we're going to learn something very powerful about God, our King, about King Messiah, and about ourselves, because we're to be a kingdom of priests, priests and kings. Okay? So the first three at the very top are Chokmah, Binah, and Da'at. Chokmah is wisdom. Binah is understanding. Da'at is knowledge. These are the Hebrew words. And when the Jews write about these, they always arrange them in this way. They look at Chokmah and Binah as being paired together. And Chokmah leads to Binah. Wisdom leads to understanding. The way they understand this, the way they describe it, is wisdom is this thing that not only you develop in life, but it's this thing that comes as a spark of insight. It's the thing that a composer, a Mozart, is just like this spark of a melody. And it unfolds in their mind. It's a spark of creativity that a writer or an artist will see, an inventor will have. There's just this, where do you get your ideas? People ask, well, I don't know. They just pop, you know, they just kind of come from the unseen world into the seen world. It's this seed. It's like the seed of the male, and it's just this sudden burst of energy. But then the next thing that must happen is to take that spark and then to spend lots and lots of time nurturing it, growing it, developing it, turn it into a plan. An architect may have a spark of insight about this incredible building he wants to build. But then comes sitting down with a pencil and paper and begin to draw it out. Put down the measurements. Choose the materials. All the time and the work it takes. They say Chokmah is like the father and Binah is like the mother. In fact, they say that Chokmah can be illustrated by the first letter of God's name, which is just a yud. It's the smallest letter of the alphabet. It's just like an apostrophe. It's just like just putting your quill to the parchment, and you've got a yud. It's like a seed. But the second letter of God's name is the letter He, and it looks like a dalet, but it has the yud inside of it, and it becomes the letter He. And I'm doing a terrible job of drawing it because this iPad just does not like to be drawn on. But anyways, it looks like this, a dalet. And there's the yud inside. They say that Binah is like the dot that is in the palace. And these two letters are the first two letters of God's name, Yah. It's illustrated, these two things, the wisdom, the burst, the pop, the seed is planted, and then gestation takes place, and that's Binah. In fact, the word Binah comes from the Hebrew word bain, which means between. And when you think, you know, I was thinking of Brian's teaching about 3-4 weeks ago. He's talking about the trillions of cells that make up the body of a newborn baby. Trillions. But it started with one seed from the father, this microscopic seed coming into the eggs, the seed, the ova of the mother. And then it divides into two. Those two divide into four. Those four into eight. And somehow, when that baby's born, there are two arms, two hands, five fingers in each hand, two legs, a foot at the end of each one, the five toes at the end of the foot. Everything's in measurement. Everything's in balance. That's miraculous. That's absolutely incredible. And that is pictured by Kokhma and Binah. And some people want to run around with their flashes of insight. And it's very difficult to work with one of these people. They're fun. They're very creative. But it's like they can never bring anything into a reality because they never can take the time to live with it long enough to really bring it into reality. This is the power of the woman, by the way. Because not only physically do the father and mother live out these two attributes, but, you know, little boys, you ask a little boy what they want to be. One day it's an astronaut, next day it's a sports star, next day it's a scientist, next day it's an explorer, next day it's... I think we want to be everything. And men, you know, we just have all these ideas. But what does the wife do? The wife comes alongside and she will accept one of these ideas and help focus the husband's energies and time and thought and take one of these and grow it into a business, into a house, into whatever it is. That's the power of a woman. And men, we need to respect that. We really, truly need to respect that. So Kokhma is like the father, Binah is like the mother, and what comes out of these is da'at, knowledge. You see, true knowledge is not just facts. And as Greek thinkers, we think facts are knowledge. Hebraic thinking, not at all. Facts are just facts. They're just the dust of wisdom that just is lying around. In Hebraic thought, da'at, which also means connection, comes from wisdom and understanding being completely integrated together. And da'at regulates the two, and what happens when the two become one? What comes forth from that is real knowledge. Real knowledge. In fact, in your translations, there may be a footnote where Paul refers to knowledge in verse 9, and then again a little later on, and the footnote may say real knowledge. He's not talking just about facts. He's talking about real knowledge. You know, in Hebraic thought, to know something means to be one with it. We first find, I think the first place the word know is used when it talks about Adam knew his wife. The two became one. And this is why the message and the messenger must be one and the same. If you're sharing the gospel with your lips, but it's not seen in your life, that's not real knowledge. You don't know the gospel. You, as the messenger, and the message that comes forth in your lips must be one and the same thing. Yeshua spoke words, but he is the word. He's one. His message and the messenger are one. And that's what it must be for us. That's what real knowledge is. That's what real da'at is. Let's look at a few other examples of how these three are used. Proverbs 2:6. For Adonai gives kokma, from his mouth come da'at and binah. There it is. In Proverbs 2:6. Proverbs 14:6. A scoffer seeks wisdom, seeks kokma, and finds none. But da'at is easy to him who has understanding, binah. Kokhma must have the binah for it to truly become knowledge. To truly become knowledge. This is why people who go to school just to learn theology may come away with a lot of theology, but not much wisdom. And not true knowledge, not real knowledge. Okay? These are very spiritual things, and they all happen in the mind. They happen in the mind, and it takes time and meditation and discipline and surrender and focus, and it doesn't happen overnight. I love Proverbs 24, 3 and 4. By Chokmah, wisdom, a house is built, and by Binah, understanding, it is established, and by knowledge, Da'at, the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Isn't that beautiful? But you find this triad, these three, found many times in Scripture. Daniel 2:21 is another example. And it is he who changes the times and epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. All right? And we could go on and on and on of verses where these three are found together. So when Paul introduces these three, Colossians 1, he's conjuring up verses where these three are found together over and over and over again. And of all the 10 midot, the 10 measurements of a king, these three are right at the top. Right at the top. But Paul does something unusual. Because you'll notice he'll use the word da'at a second time. Because this is what it says. For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the da'at of his will and all spiritual kokma and binah, wisdom and understanding, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of the master. And then it goes on and says, and increasing in the da'at, in the knowledge of God. He uses knowledge two times. This is very purposeful. Because when you see these diagrammed, you'll often see them diagrammed like this. You see, above kokma and bina, wisdom and understanding, is keter, which means crown. And the rabbis teach this also is knowledge. So you see knowledge above and you see knowledge below. Because after all, if we're getting wisdom and understanding from God, it's because God has knowledge. But we can't talk about this knowledge up here. It is so supernal and holy and wonderful and above us and almost impossible for us to tap into. We can only know it as God reveals it through wisdom and understanding, and which in turn reproduce knowledge in our lives. And so when you see these graphed out, they'll either, if they use keter at the top, they will not use da'at at the bottom. But if they use da'at down here, they will not use keter at the top. They just use one or the other for some reason. Paul, though, uses both. He refers to both. Now, what we're going to see as we go through these 10, the one at the very top is keter, crown. And the one at the very bottom is malchut, which means kingdom. So I want you to get a picture in your mind right now. Picture, a crown. And down here is the kingdom. What is between the crown and the kingdom? What's between the crown and the kingdom? The king. The king. What you're going to see here is an image of a king. It's an image of Melech HaOlam, the king of the universe. It's a picture of King Messiah. But it also is to be a picture of us as priests and kings, royalty. It's something we should aspire to. It is going to bring us, show us balance, what balance looks like. And again, what I'm showing you, the diagram was assembled by the rabbis over thousands of years, but it all comes right out of the Hebrew scriptures, the Hebrew words that are used there. And I think if you follow along, you'll find this to be a fascinating ride. And it may answer some issues in your life where you find imbalances and deficiencies. Do you find yourself sometimes find it difficult to follow through on something, to bring something to fruition? You find you make it so far that things collapse. It's probably because one of these is out of order. So what I'm sharing with you is a very ancient wisdom that comes out of the scriptures, but has been put together into a way, a picture, a graph that helps us to picture these things in a very concrete way. So let's move on. Here's how you can think of these 10 things. You've all, in science class, probably taken a prism and you shoot a beam of white light in the side and out the other side comes the rainbow, right? Well, that white light is like the knowledge of Keter, God's knowledge, God himself. He is light, right? God is light. And in him is no shadow of turning, no darkness whatsoever. But light itself is invisible. And even here, Paul refers to God as the invisible God. You know, if you're out in space, in the blackness of space, and someone shoots a beam of light right in front of your nose, you know you can't see that beam of light. It's invisible. But if you put up your hand and the light hits your hand, you can see your hand. You can only see how light interacts with other things. But light itself, believe it or not, is invisible. You can only see how light interacts with things. That's all the only way you can see it. If it's not interacting with something, you can't see it. So here, they're showing as if a beam of light, say in the prism. But what happens in the prism? It unfolds that light into all the colors of the rainbow. You got your red and your orange and your yellow and green and blue and indigo and violet, and there are probably all kinds of shades and mixtures in between there, but the seven colors of the rainbow. And so what we're doing is we're taking the light of who God is, we're basically breaking it down into these 10 things. But they're all part of Him. They're all Him. All right? Beneath, now remember, we've got Chokmah and Binah, wisdom and understanding, and they come together as knowledge. And all of these are part, they all happen up here. They're up here in the mind, the brain. You know, in Hebraic thought, spiritual activity takes place up here in the mind. Somehow, in the world, we have this mistaken notion that spiritual activity takes place in sensations and feelings. Now, those are physical things. But true spirituality is invisible. It's unseen, it's something that is still and calm, and it's pure light, and it takes place up here. So, as we descend, we find three other things. We find chesed and gevurah. You know, oftentimes you'll hear me share about chesed and gevurah. Chesed is loving kindness. It's completely gratuitous, completely unearned. It's just flooding out there. This is the kind of feeling you have when you have your first child. Oh, you want to buy it. All the baby clothes you see, all the baby toys you see, all the baby furniture you see, and you want to paper the walls, and the baby doesn't care about any of it, but oh, you just want to flood this baby, get all the healthy foods, play brain-stimulating music in its room, and put mobiles over it. Just flood this baby with everything. But what happens if you keep raising your children with complete chesed, complete loving kindness, just flooding them with everything they want and could desire? You'll destroy them. You will destroy your children. They will never grow to maturity because chesed must be regulated by what's called gevurah. Gevurah is might and power. You've heard of El Gabor. You know, Gabor is like a hill. It's something, it's a force of nature. Boom. And you can't push through it. When you might be running along, you come to Gabor, and it's like, boom, you're going to stop. Because it's like they're restraining you. Chesed must be tempered by gevurah. Loving kindness must be tempered by, hold back a little bit. I mean, take for example your child. I want candy. Okay, honey, here's a piece of candy. I want more candy. And what do? No, one piece is enough. That's gevurah. You limit it. Now, remember, gevurah is not there to completely balance chesed. It's not there to be exactly equal. It is there so that chesed can be experienced to the max. And you realize if you give that child one piece of candy instead of a whole box, they're going to enjoy the candy the most. Also, they're not going to rot out their teeth. Also, they're not going to get sugar diabetes. Also, they're not going to get so obese they can't fit through the door. All things which will really limit your experience of joy in this life. You understand? So, gevurah comes along to enhance chesed the most, but there must be some restriction, some limitation. On the other hand, some parents, they're real big in gevurah. Discipline, discipline, that's what we're going to have. That can destroy your children as well. If it's not, unless it's applied to an abundance of chesed. Now, the sages always say these things are never in equal parts. God's chesed is always greater than his gevurah. Just like the right arm, if you're right-handed, is stronger than the left. In fact, when you go back to Exodus 34 and God gives his 13 attributes of mercy, remember the first three? The first one is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He gives his name. The second one is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He gives his name a second time. The third one is El, which is short for Elohim. And everybody wonders, why does he do that? Why does he say his name, which we don't know how to pronounce, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Then he says it again, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and then he says El, Elohim. That's because when he says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, when God uses his name, we say Adonai, when we, instead of trying to pronounce his name. When you see the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, it always is capturing God's attribute of mercy. But when you see El or Elohim, it's expressing his attribute of strict justice. So when he gives us 13 attributes, why does he say Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh twice? Because that's greater than the Elohim, his strict justice. Always is. And that's the way it needs to be when we raise our children. But to raise them in this total gratuitous, just have whatever you want, because I love you, love you, love you, you'll destroy them. Absolutely destructive. So how do we know? How do we know how to balance these? Well, that's Tiferet, which means beauty. And now there are several words in the scriptures that mean beauty. But Tiferet, even the way it's spelled, how it starts with a tav and ends with a tav, it's beauty that comes from balance and from symmetry. Yeah, I've shared before how scientists have done studies of the faces of women that men consider beautiful and women consider beautiful. They show them all these faces, and they'd have you just look at a face and rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, which is the most beautiful. And they found the higher scores, the woman's face had one thing, always one thing in common, and that is the left side of the face and the right side of the face are symmetrical. They might have one side of the face that honestly doesn't look all that great. Maybe the eye's a little weird or whatever. But when you completely make it symmetrical on the other side, it comes across as beauty. Wired into our souls is this thing that says symmetry is beautiful. And Tiferet is that beauty of symmetry. And it is there to regulate chesed and gavura. How do we do this? How do we do this as parents? How do we do this as employers? How do we do this as congregational leaders? Where you want to lavish everything on the people you love, but you realize that there has to be some limitation or else you destroy them, you harm them. How do you do this? Well, that's the tough question. That's a $64 question, isn't it? I guess it takes a lot of wisdom and understanding and knowledge to do that. Tiferet is also called truth in the Bible. And in a couple passages that use the word Tiferet, there's Exodus 28:2, where God tells Moses, "And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for glory and Tiferet for beauty." And Proverbs 4, 5, and 5 through 9, this is what it says, "Acquire chokmah, acquire wisdom. Acquire binah, understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her. She will guard you. Love her. She will watch over you. The beginning of wisdom, chokmah, is," you ready? "The beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. Acquire chokmah." How you like that? "And with all your acquiring, get binah, get understanding. Prize her and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a garland of grace. She will present you with a crown of Tiferet." So, what's the purpose of getting as much wisdom and understanding as you can? So you'll have this. And you can regulate these. You follow? All right. I hope you are. I hope I'm not losing you. I said this is the deep end of the pool, didn't I? But it just keeps getting better. Keeps getting better. Let's look at a couple passages here. Chesed and Gevura. In Romans 11:22, Paul writes, "Behold then the kindness and severity of God." Well, I'll tell you what he was thinking. He was saying, "Behold the chesed and Gevura of God." Those are the words that lie behind the Greek words up here. Kindness and severity. God exercises these in perfect balance. Why? Because he's the fun police and just wants to squash our fun? No, he wants to enhance our joy to the max. You know, I've shared before how C.S. Lewis writes that Satan never created a single pleasure. Every pleasure in the world comes from God. Satan never created a single one. But what does Satan try to do? He tries to get you to enjoy the pleasures of God in the wrong way, to the wrong degree, or at the wrong time. In other words, he wants to wipe out the balance, the Tiferet. Just take all the pleasure. Well, what happens to these people? Their souls become numb. So they have to work harder and harder and harder to get some fun out of their sin. It's like with an addict, that first drug you take, wow, that was incredible. Second time, it's not so great. Third time, it's not so great. Fourth time, it's not so great. You have to take more and more and more, and but at the same time, you lose your freedom. You lose your soul. You lose your willpower. You become a slave. And if Satan could take away all the pleasure altogether, he would, because that's the one part God contributes. You understand? God, on the other hand, brings gavura in a perfectly beautiful, measured, symmetrical way. So our enjoyment of his loving kindness, his pleasures, his goodness, we've maximized. This is why in marriage, the Torah gives us very specific instructions about how sex is to be used and how it's not to be used. Not because he wants to ruin our fun. He wants to make your enjoyment of this beautiful gift the best it can be, the greatest it can be. Okay? Everybody follow? If I keep asking that, you don't say anything, so I'll assume that's a yes. I will accept your silence as, yes, Grant, we follow you.
Yes, Grant.
Thank you, Deborah. Thanks. Now, beneath these three, you find the final ones. Okay, we had the three. We had wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Below those, you find loving kindness and then power, gevura, and tiferet. And then below those, you find the final four, netzach, hod, yesod, and then down below that, malkut. You think of this as a funnel. And everything comes from God above and funnels down to finally this. Now, netzach also means power. Gevura means power. Netzach also means power. But the power is applied in a different way. Whereas gevura is like power, like a linebacker where you come charging in, I'm going to stand there and hold you back. That's one kind of power, the power to resist and restrain. But netzach is the kind of power that moves forward, goes on the offense. And it goes to gain ground. It goes on the attack. It moves forward and makes progress. You got it? So netzach is a different word for power. Balancing it out is a word is hod, which means glory or praise. Then down at the very bottom is malkut. Now, did you ever notice Yeshua's prayer, the Lord's prayer? He says, may your kingdom come. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And then he ends the prayer, for thine is the malkut and the netzach and the hod. He's referring to these well-established concepts. Because he says, if everything is done in balance, if everything is done the right way with wisdom and with understanding, with knowledge, and if chesed and gevura applied with tiferet, with beauty, your kingdom will come. You follow? Everybody see how this is working together? So these are not foreign concepts that rabbis made up. These are all biblical concepts, and we find them in the mouth of the master. So what are netzach and hod? Netzach, which is triumph, it also means eternity. It's a word for power and strength. It's a receptacle for chesed. Now, let me describe it this way. Chesed is just this, I just want to give. I just want to pour out everything on the people I love. But what happens when you give and people don't want to receive? What happens when you have a desire to teach truth and people don't want to learn? You have this desire to serve and people say, well, leave me alone. What do? You quit? Turn around and go home? No. This is netzach. You continue to move forward. You find a way to inspire. You don't quit. But you look at how you can accomplish the mission God has given you. How many stories? I mean, look at the story of Moses. Moses, you go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. You got it. He goes and tells Pharaoh, let my people go. He does his signs, and Pharaoh basically boots him out of the palace, and he comes back to the people. And not only that, but Pharaoh says, by the way, keep the brickwork up. I'm taking away the straw. You've got to find your own. This is worse than it was before. Moses probably felt like, let's just go home. The people are thinking, Moses, a lot of help you are. You see? But they pressed on. They looked to God, and God sent us promises and continued to direct. And this is Netzach. This is the triumph. We keep moving forward. Yeshua comes to be the Messiah of Israel. What happens? They execute him for no reason at all. What does he do? Netzach. He rises from the dead. He forgives his enemies. And he's still returning to bring the kingdom. He keeps moving on. So, you know, Gevura is where you must put a limitation on Chesed. But Netzach is when you continue to pour forth your chesed, your loving kindness, even when there's resistance that is not of God. You follow? On the other hand, Hod is very different. You know how Gevura is, it tempers the flood of chesed so it doesn't destroy? Hod is when I apply Gevura to my own life. It means I have to humble myself. Did you ever work for somebody who didn't want you working for them because they wanted it all done their way? So let's just do it themselves. I'll just do it my own way. I'll do it my own self. And if the plans don't turn out quite right, they're just angry and mad. Hod is being able to humble yourself, being able to set things aside and adjust and compromise and work with the hand you're dealt. And it always takes great humility. It takes brokenness. You know, I don't want to embarrass my lovely niece, but when I think of Hod, I think of Bethany. You know, Bethany and Michael got married about 6 months ago, right? And Bethany is a very gifted event planner. And you get an event planner planning her own wedding, it's going to be a knockout. And Bethany had planned every detail. It was incredible. And it was an outdoor wedding, or it was supposed to be. But God had other plans. And that morning it started raining, and it rained, 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 and it rained. And you see, someone who doesn't have Hod would say, well, by Jiminy, we're just going to stand out there and get wet. That's all there is to it, you know? But Bethany didn't. Bethany was able to say, okay, I had these plans. Those aren't going to come through. And so it all had to be moved indoors. Everything had to be adjusted. Everything had to be changed. She had to compromise with the weather. But you know what? People who came to the wedding, I don't think they ever would have known that it was supposed to be an outdoor wedding because it was perfect. It was beautiful. Okay? So Hod is being able to break my own self-will, to accept the assistance of others, to set my own plans aside. The way one person put it, it's the willingness to transcend one's own ego in order to achieve a goal. And it's the ability to identify the essence of the goal and let go of its superficial elements. Okay? And then yesod, which means foundation, is like the bottom of the funnel. It inherits all of the things above it. They all come flowing down into this place. And this is what happens right before you take action. You've examined, you've made your plans, you've got directions from God, you've applied the scriptures, you've examined your own heart, and you've submitted yourself to God, and how you leave the outcome in his hands, and you've humbled yourself, and you're determined to press on regardless of what happens, and all this comes down, and then Malkut is where you actually do it. In other words, you don't actually do anything until this one. Malkut, kingdom. Some rabbis call this Shekinah, the dwelling of God. It's where God actually shows up, where something happens in the physical realm. Until then, it's all happened internally and spiritually. But Malkut means the kingdom is here. God's will is being done on earth. Whether it's just in the realm of your own life, in the realm of a community, in the realm of the entire body of Messiah, this is when things show up in the physical realm. Everybody follow me so far? Yes, Grant. Say yes, Grant. Okay. Now, if we put all of these together, they look kind of like this. Okay, you got it? So you have the crown at the top, and these three here are all in, they're all spiritual. And it's a spiritual awareness. It's all in the thoughts. But then when you get down to these, you're getting down to the level of the attitude and your emotions. Then when you get down to these, I'll tell you what you're doing. You're conquering fear. And a lot of people get this far, and then fear blocks them from acting. They're filled with wisdom and understanding and knowledge and loving kindness and self-discipline and beauty and balance, but then fear prevents them from ever bringing forth into the world the things, the rich inner world that God has given them. Fear. This is where fear hits. This is where fear tackles us. You see how they work? Now, why am I going through all of these? Oh, let me share this too. You know that I love this verse in Proverbs 25:11, like apples of gold in settings of silver, as a word appropriately spoken. I look at this chesed, gevurah, and tiferet as being like the apples. But apples need a container. Need something to rest in. And Netzach and Hod are the receptacles for Kesed and Gevurah. And these are like this is like the silver basket. But they have to sit on a table, and that's Yesod. I don't know if Solomon had these concepts in mind when he wrote that verse. It's just a picture I have. But here's why we're going through these. Let's go back to Colossians now. I probably thought I'd forgotten all about Colossians. Let's read verse 9 again, and we're going to go on with verses 10 through 13, 14. It says, for this reason also, since the day we heard of it, of your faith, your response to the gospel, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, of the Master, to please him in all respects, or pleasing to him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, for the attaining of steadfastness and patience, joyously giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to share in the inheritance of the saints in light, for he rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom, the Malkut, of his beloved Son. You know, if you substitute the words we've been using here, it reads like this. For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the da'at of his will and all spiritual chokmah and binah, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of the Master, teferet in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the da'at of God, strengthened with gevurah, according to his glorious netzach, for the attaining of all chesed and hod, joyously giving thanks to the Father, who has qualified us to share in the yesod of the Holy Ones in light. For he rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the malchut of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, forgiveness of sins. See what Paul's doing? He's taking these ancient Jewish concepts, about which thousands of books have been written, and he's saying, this is what I want for you. Now let's review again why these are important. First of all, these are the measures, the midot, the measures, the balances that a king must have in his life to be a good king. Now, it has to be loving kindness, but it has to be tempered and regulated with strength. And these have to be balanced in perfect beauty. You think of Camelot. You've seen a movie about Camelot and King Arthur. Everything's just beautiful. The castle's beautiful. Fresh coat of paint. You know, and the banners on the walls. It's beautiful. Because apparently, according to legend, King Arthur had a beautiful soul. He was wise and understanding and knowledgeable. He loved his people. But he knew what limitations. He knew how to exercise justice. And when you have a king, a ruler, who's wise and is what he should be, his kingdom will reflect all of that. But we too are kings. We're called priests and kings. And we need to grow up into this. And what Paul has given us is a picture, a little bit of a picture of what God looks like. See, now when we want a picture, we want something that's an image, a shape, a painting, a portrait, a face. Well, you can't draw God that way. What you do is you draw these balancing attributes that are his, that he exercises for perfection, absolute perfection. And Messiah, the King of Kings, King Messiah, he walked in these in perfect perfection and balance, never misstepping once. And he did it all without fear. And when you saw Messiah, you saw him acting, you saw the kingdom of God on earth. But he says that the kingdom is within you, the Malkut's within you as well. But what you need to do is strengthen the parts of this that are weak. Maybe reduce the things that are oversized and imbalancing. And then develop the things that aren't there at all. And start to live like me. Because you see, when you look at these, you see a picture of Messiah, who is the image of God. Because let's go on. Verse 14. He, Messiah, is the image of the invisible God. God is invisible. Let's just get that down right now. God is invisible. We're told this over and over. You can't see God. Now, in the spiritual realm, you can. And somehow, Isaiah saw the Lord seated on his throne and the train of his robe filling the temple with glory. Well, I don't know quite how that worked. We just know that if someone, no one can see God and live. Now, you can see God, but you won't survive the experience, is what he's saying. But what we can do is look at his attributes. So if you want a picture of who God is and what he looks like, you must look at Messiah living out these attributes. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Now let's stop there for a second. Firstborn does not mean born first, even though Yeshua preexisted Adam and everything else. But firstborn means preeminent, the one in authority. And usually that preeminence is given to the firstborn son. But if that firstborn son messes up, it can go to the second son, or the third, or the fourth. We see this happening with the tribes of Israel. Who is Jacob's firstborn son? Reuben. But Reuben violated his father's bed. You can read the story in Genesis. So the firstborn status was taken away from him, given it to Simeon and Levi. But they messed up. The whole story of Dinah when they went into Shechem and had the men circumcise themselves on the third day when they're in the most pain, they went and just killed them all. So Jacob took it away from Simeon and Levi and passed it on to Judah, the fourth born. And Judah is the one who became the kingly tribe. Right? That's where the kings came from. But later, Levi stood strong in the story of the golden calf. So God took the priesthood part of the firstborn and gave it to Levi, moved it up a notch, gave it to Levi. And so in Judah we see the authority of rulership, and in Levi we see the priesthood. Because the firstborn of a family was the one who ruled over the siblings and the grandchildren, and he was also the priest of the home. When you look at the story of Adam, and you look at the description of the work God gives Adam to do, to tend, to guard, protect the garden, and to rule over the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and all the animals. When you look at what he tells him to do, this is firstborn terminology he's using. Because you could say Adam was the firstborn of the earth, and God gave him authority. He abdicated all of that, though. But Yeshua precedes Adam. He's the firstborn of all creation. It's like you have the Levitical priesthood, right? But there's a priesthood that came before that. That's the priesthood of Melchizedek, which continues on way past the priesthood of Levi into eternity. But that's another story. So when he talks about him being the firstborn, it means he has the preeminence as priest and king over the creation. Verse 16, for in him all things were created, both in the heavens, that's the spiritual realm, and on the earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. So he's the firstborn of all creation. But look what comes next. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. In physics, we call that the strong force. We're trying to figure out why atoms hold together. Well, Colossians 1:17 tells us it's through Messiah. But that's another story as well. Verse 18, he is also the head of the body, the kahal, the called out ones. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. Well, wait a minute. He has two firstborn statuses. Firstborn of all creation, also firstborn of the dead. He has authority over all the dead. He has the keys to death and the grave. You know, when people want to know, why did Messiah have to come? You can say he came to die for our sins. That's true. Came to give us eternal life. That's true. But there's an overarching theme. He came to completely repair the damage done by Adam. Completely, totally, with not one loose end left over. He came to repair all the damage done by Adam. Adam did a lot of damage. Death entered into the world. And Paul tells us in Romans 5 that we all inherit death because of Adam. Well, Yeshua was the firstborn of the dead. So he can reverse that as well. The world came under a curse. The world came under a curse. Well, Messiah comes. He's the firstborn of all creation. He takes away the curse. He came and he died so as to take away our sins. So all the sin that came into the world through Adam and Eve's act of theft, all undone. He comes completely, totally, without any loose ends, completely correct the error and the sin, the damage caused by Adam to the universe. That's an amazing Savior there. Anyways, I got some other verb. What else do I have up here? 2 Corinthians 4:4. Oh, yes. In whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Messiah, who is the image of God. You know, like one child said, Yeshua is God with the skin on. John 12:44-45. And Yeshua cried out and said, he who believes in me does not believe in me, but in him who sent me. And he who beholds me beholds the one who sent me. He's the image of God. Romans 11:36, for from him and through him and to him are all things, to him be the glory forever. And if you look at Colossians 2:9, it says, for in him all the fullness of, and it's an odd Greek word, it's only used here in the entire Bible, theotes, the theotes. And they try to translate this deity, Godhead, divine nature. I think it's referring to those 10 midot that we showed. All of those dwell in him bodily, in perfection. And I want to finish with this. As you go through here, you'll see that there are four things, four roles Yeshua came to fill. Verse 15, it says that he is the image of the invisible God. So if you're taking notes, you can mark that as number one. He's the image of the invisible God. By seeing Yeshua, we see a picture of God. Number two, he's the firstborn of all creation. Go down to verse 18. He is also head of the body, the kahal, the called out ones. That's number three. And number four, he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. So that he himself will come to have first place and everything. Paul lays out here four roles of Messiah. And when you look at these, you begin to realize that these are four things that were broken by Adam. And now they're fulfilled by the last Adam, Yeshua. Adam was made in God's image, wasn't he? But see, Adam wanted more than that. He wanted equality with God. Like it says in Philippians 2:6. It refers to Yeshua, says, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. You see, Adam did think it was a thing to be grasped. Satan told him, oh, you eat of this, you get the knowledge of good and evil, you'll be like God. And Adam says, I want that. And he grasped it. Yeshua didn't. Okay? He did not fall for the thing Adam fell for. So he restores the image that Adam lost, was broken. Firstborn of all creation, Adam was the first, he's the firstborn of earth. But Yeshua comes as the firstborn of all creation. He trumps Adam. And so when Adam, the little brother, when he busted stuff, big brother comes, Yeshua comes to restore it all. He's the head of the kahal. The kahal is the bride. Adam didn't do a good job protecting his bride. Messiah comes to protect his bride, the kahal, the called out ones, the bride of Messiah. And because of Adam, his sin, he died, Eve died, all of his children die, we die. But Yeshua comes to be the firstborn of the dead. He says, that's okay, I got you covered. Death has no victory anymore. There's no sting. I have victory over it. You will too. It's amazing when you look at it. Okay? I want to give you this one last picture of God. You can look at the 10 things. You look at these 4 things. But here's another picture of God that's more immediate, more physical. You look at your neighbor. One who's been walking with the Lord for a long time. They're not perfect, but they're probably as good a picture of God you'll ever see in this lifetime. Someone who walks in joy, in balance and tiferet, in wisdom and in understanding, who has knowledge of God and knowledge of people, who has put the ego aside. They've practiced that netzach, that hod, rather. And they know how to persevere, even when things are against them. They walk in netzach, and they keep moving forward. There's no fear in them. And when they do deeds, God's will to be done on earth as is in heaven, because they're doing things that please Him. Find a person like that. It could be a man or a woman. They could be not very good looking. But when you look at their life, you're seeing a picture of God. And God wants to restore that image in every one of us. He's got His work cut out for Him with us, but you know what? He's patient, and He's a good teacher, and He's determined that He restores His image in every one of us. Isn't this an amazing chapter? Yes, Grant. It's an amazing chapter. We got off to a little bit of a late start, so let's take just 2 or 3 comments, questions, and we're going to start with you, Tony. So if we have a microphone, let's get it over there towards Tony.
And God said, do you think I created your mind, your brain, for only using 10%?
Yeah.
He said, let me open up your brain to my wisdom. And, you know, we try to understand God with that little peanut brain, the small part. He wants to be in the void, to fill us so we understand what He's saying. Adam must have been brilliant.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and as mankind has fallen, now we think that we can truly know God only using a particle of our brain.
Yeah.
That really struck me, and I thought, if we could utilize the 90% that's busy focusing on Him, we will see the power in us. We will know the power of God.
That's great. I appreciate that, Tony. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, right now, one of the things that will make you wiser and make you smarter is humility. When Satan is described, I can't remember if it's in Jeremiah. I think it's Jeremiah. And it says that, or Ezekiel. I can never remember. The profits are always a pile in my mind. I'm not using 10% of my brain, I think. But it says by reason, his wisdom was corrupted because of his beauty, because of his pride. And it's like, I thought, that's interesting. Pride corrupts your wisdom. Humility, that's the beginning of wisdom. Humility is one of the best things you can do for your IQ and for your wisdom. Yeah, absolutely. Mim. Let's get a microphone up here to Mim. By the way, we used your song this morning. Thank you for sharing. Your grace is still amazing. Yes. Yes. I love that song. Okay, there we go.
Okay, I'm gonna say when you mentioned about the three parts,
yeah,
about the ten verbs.
Yes.
What stops us from being obedient to God is fear.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that, and I see in my life, sometimes I will, you know, by the grace of God, I will get the wisdom and spending time in His Word, and then understanding. But then when fear hits, you know, and the enemies are throwing all kinds of lies, and that's when it stops. So I'll just share a little bit of what happened to me this week. I went to the store and I came back home and there was a piece of jewelry inside my purse and I didn't buy it, but it was in there somehow. It must have knocked in my purse, and I actually told Ryan about it. I said, I'm planning today to go back, you know, to take that back, and said, you know, I don't even know how that got in here. But then all of a sudden, because I used to steal things in Thailand, and before God, you know, revealed in all these lies and all these fears are coming into my head. What did they think you stole it? Who can believe that? You know, but I'm going to do it because I'm not going to have the fear of what it is that the enemy is trying to. And it said in the Word, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Yes.
So many times when I obey God and obey Him, good fruit came out of it. Peace and joy. And there's like,
that's wonderful.
It's so good to walk in obedience and just let that fear be gone.
Yeah, if you have a fear of God, you don't need to fear anything else, do you? Yeah, something you shared. I was on the phone with a friend of mine, a very wise man who's a very, very godly counselor. And he was saying sometimes the things we go through in our lives, like when you're in Thailand, for you knew the Lord, you would, I guess you were a real terror on the streets, stealing things and
in jail.
Beating up kids and so on. But anyways, he says that these traumatic experiences are like tattoos on our souls. And it's a painful thing to get it, but it's even more painful to get it off. And it takes the love of other people and knowing God loves you and fear of God before we can really begin to remove that tattoo in our soul and have it clean again. That really stuck with me. So we're going to take one more comment, and it's going to be Adam over here, and then we'll close in prayer.
Vessels of the Word, you know, different attributes of personality, and how we rely on each other to help us out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes you don't have the restraint necessary to behave appropriately, and that's when someone can come alongside you and say, hey, maybe rein it in a notch.
Yes.
How much, even though we see there's individual attributes to us in our lives, we still rely on a community.
Yeah.
For those, even thinking about, you know, wisdom is the highest, and it's from what the other ones told, but when you're young, you need your parents, they provide that wisdom, and it's what gives you a bit of that restraint. So I just think it's interesting how even looking at the individual, it still demonstrates ways that we can help and love each other.
Good point. But you know, when you're talking, Adam, I was thinking about our board of elders. We get together, and you know, I've always said, individually, we're not very impressive, but put all together, we make one pretty good guy. And so a topic will come up, and one person's all chesed, oh, let's go for it. Another person's a little gavura. Well, wait a minute here. We need to back off. And then Dan will come through some tiferet and say, well, here's a balance for this whole thing. And it's amazing. Right? I see these attributes working through this group of men. And it's really an amazing thing to watch. And as we submit to one another, it seems like God's wisdom and comes through, and his malkut comes into the world. You know, his will is done. So, well, I hope this has been beneficial to you. It gives you a framework to think about what it means to be, to walk in balance, to measure out various attributes. All of these attributes are good, but they have to be balanced with other good attributes or they become damaging. And if you want these graphics, they'll all be on the website tomorrow, and you can just print them right out, so the notes I have in front of me, you'll have in front of you, okay? And everything you saw on the screen, you can just print it right out and have it. So let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, we thank you so much that you are the perfect King, the King of Kings. And Lord, you've revealed yourself to us so that we could be more like you. We could restore the image of Adam in our lives. Better than that, the image of the last Adam, Messiah, your Savior, the image of you, the invisible God. So, Father, I pray we would meditate on these things and we would seek wisdom, because if we have wisdom and understanding and knowledge, all of these other things can take their proper place in the proper way. So make us the people you want us to be, and help us to grow up into your full image, we ask in Yeshua's precious name. Amen. All right, let's stand. You've been sitting.